The second case for oral argument this morning is James Smith, petitioner and appellant versus Douglas Weber, the warden of the state penitentiary, respondent and appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. James Ehrenberg, who is an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee warden, we have Mr. Gary Campbell, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, a trial judge from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place. Mr. Ehrenberg, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Associate Justices, Mr. Campbell. I'm here today to primarily discuss two issues that I feel are the most compelling in Mr. Smith's case. First, that Mr. Golden, the appellate counsel in the first habeas corpus case, rendered ineffective assistance of counsel. First, the habeas counsel at the trial court level was Deborah Bergen. We believe she was improperly removed by Circuit Court Judge Kathleen Caldwell, and then Golden was substituted as counsel. And before filing a notice of appeal on time, Mr. Golden had evidently filed a motion to withdraw and then was actually allowed to withdraw after the time for filing the notice of appeal. So Mr. Smith's appeal was never perfected and he was never allowed to appeal in that first habeas corpus case. Secondly, we believe that another structural error occurred, and that occurred at the trial court level regarding the criminal charges, in that a mandatory jury instruction was not given to the jury.
Haven't we said, though, that jury instructions are not appropriate in habeas proceedings, that they're more in the nature of a direct appeal issue?
Well, that may be the general rule, but here we have a statutorily mandated jury instruction, and we believe that the failure to give this particular jury instruction rose to the level of a structural error. And that is when an error becomes a part of a limited class of fundamental errors, so intrinsically harmful to require automatic reversal without regard to their effect on the trial's outcome. They render a trial fundamentally unfair. That is, the failure to give this particular statutorily mandated jury instruction on the requirement of the jury to corroborate the testimony of the accomplice, Paul Wood, a structural error occurred, and the reviewing court must apply or cannot apply harmless error in such a case. And the United States Supreme Court decisions discussed the structural error, such as the giving of an erroneous reasonable doubt instruction to a jury, or the total deprivation of a right to counsel, such as was discussed in the case of Gideon versus Wainwright. And in fact, that same case supports Mr. Smith's argument to the court that because Golden did not timely file the notice of appeal, Smith was denied his right to appeal, which constituted a fundamental or structural error causing his right to
On that issue, do you agree that the requirement of corroboration is not an element of the offense that the jury must find?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, it's not considered to be what would be called an essential element.
So there doesn't need to be a jury finding on that to support a conviction. There has to be evidence of corroboration, of course.
Yes, the statute, the South Dakota statute, requires that the jury, as part of its critical analysis of the entire case, determine that that the essential elements, in fact, must be corroborated.
So if it's not an essential element that the jury must find, why can't the court look to see if there is a matter of law sufficient corroborating evidence in the record?
Well, what that would do, in effect, is it would cause the appellate court to sit as the 13th juror in the case and determine what the facts are of the case, and it would assess the credibility of the witnesses.
Well, here we have a man who shoots somebody in the back, who shoots a 78-year-old lady in the back of the head in the bank, and there's other people around. We have a lot of eyewitnesses. So what evidence needs to be corroborated beyond the eyewitness testimony?
Well, the accomplice, the statutory requirement is that the testimony of the accomplice needs to be corroborated. And because that jury instruction, essential jury instruction, was not given to the jury was not able to undertake the critical analysis it was required to make in order for the law to operate and for, in order for my client to have a fair trial by an impartial jury.
But in this situation, is there any need whatsoever for any accomplice testimony? I mean, let's assume just for a minute you have 10 eyewitnesses that say Smith shot this elderly lady in the back of the head. Why do you need any accomplice testimony as to what they did back when they were getting in a car or finding their guns to go do this or deciding on whether or not to rob the bank? Why do you need any accomplice testimony when you've got, when the heart of the matter is eyewitness testimony as to who shot her in the back of the head?
Well, that's for the jury to figure out. But here, clearly, the state must have thought its star witness, that is Paul Wood, was needed, was essential and critical to its case, or it certainly never would have offered a basically cream puff or very liberal plea agreement to Mr. Wood, who appeared at the very end of the case. Obviously, the state thought its case was weak enough to require giving a sweetheart deal to the accomplice in a very heinous case. There's no doubt about that.
No matter what the state thought or didn't think, if there's no need for any accomplice testimony, why should there be a need for an instruction on accomplice testimony?
Well, we don't concede that there was no need for accomplice.
No, I know it, but I mean, you know, I guess it seems pretty plain when there's eyewitness testimony that Smith shot her in the back of the head. Now, why do you need an accomplice testimony as to something else?
Well, first of all, the observation is always subject to argument as to exactly what happened. And it was only the testimony of Wood who could supply various critical facts to the jury, actually who shot the person. You know, Wood was probably in the best position to say whether it was himself or somebody else that actually shot Ms. Stensland.
Did the two eyewitnesses identify Smith as shooting her? Not besides Wood?
I think the evidence shows that there was one witness who testified it was her belief that he did, but she was also in, I believe the testimony would show, in the process of moving down to the floor, and was questionable as to, you know, exactly the accuracy of her observation. So then it becomes extremely important for Wood to come in and testify as an accomplice as to what he observed, because he was in a standing position close to the defendant, James Smith.
Excuse me, you indicated in your brief that Smith's convictions were substantially procured by the testimony of Wood. Is that based on a finding or a conclusion reached by the habeas court?
I don't believe the habeas court made that particular finding. I believe it's a fair conclusion. Even though it's speculation on my part as to exactly what the jury...
So that's based on your reading of the record and your review of what the evidence was?
That would be correct.
Okay.
In fact, only the jury knows exactly what was going through its mind at the time and how it arrived at the conclusions it did, which makes the fact that the corroboration instruction was so important to this particular case. Even though the court may feel there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, it simply is not permitted to and shouldn't sit as a 13th juror or as a fact finder determining whether or not the error was harmless, because it's structural error. And the legislator would not have made that particular jury instruction mandatory if it wasn't such a crucial instruction and crucial to the critical analysis that a jury has to make as the fact finder of the case. I would also like to talk about the fact that Mr. Smith Smith was denied justice in his habeas corpus case and an inability to get to the issues that he wished to raise on appeal because Judge Caldwell removed Ms. Bergen, his trial counsel in the habeas case, without his knowledge or consent. It appears from the record that at some point, Deputy State's Attorney Mark Arndt, who had argued the case for the state at the trial court level in the habeas case, joined the May Johnson Doyle and Becker firm, as that firm was known at the time. And we don't know exactly why Judge Caldwell removed Bergen, but it was apparently or possible that the judge thought there was now a conflict because of the deputy state's attorney joining the firm. But at any rate, we do know that we don't know exactly what happened. No hearing was granted by Judge Caldwell to determine whether Ms. Bergen should be removed because of an alleged conflict. We don't know whether or not a screening procedure that was used, such as that was used in a case of Matter of RB, where a public defender joined a prosecutor's office in Minnehaha County, kind of the reverse situation. And that prosecutor was properly screened, and the Minnehaha County State's Attorney's Office continued in their prosecution of that particular defendant.
How does the Bergen removal issue fit in with the issues that were certified to come up on appeal from the second habeas court? The ineffective assistance of Golden, ineffective assistance of Peterson, and the accomplice instruction.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what you're...
Well, you're raising the issue about Bergen being improperly removed. Is
right.
that part of one of those three issues, the Golden ineffective issue? And how does it...
Well, it leads to how Golden arrived to begin with. Had Bergen not been removed, I don't think we would have had a... We would have arrived at the position where the appeal would have been short-circuited. We know that Mr. Smith was getting along well with Ms. Bergen. There wasn't a communication problem that Golden later alleged existed, that Mr. Smith was disagreeable, hard to get along with, and refused to meet with him. That problem would not have occurred had Bergen been allowed to remain as counsel.
Well, wait a minute. Are you suggesting there's record evidence that had Bergen remained, an appeal would have been filed?
I believe that is true, that she specifically requested Judge Caldwell to issue a certificate of probable cause so that Smith could file an appeal. And I believe she stated in the record there were 14 issues that Mr. Smith wanted to raise. Whether or not all were viable or not would be a matter for this court to have ultimately determined. But we know that he was not having problems, that is, Mr. Smith was not having problems with getting along with Ms. Bergen. So we know that should she have been allowed to stay on as counsel, I don't think there would have been a issue that there's some communication problem, whether or not Mr. Smith wanted Mr. Golden to stay on and at least perfect his appeal so that a brief could be prepared. We also know that once Mr. Golden was brought onto the case, that there was evidently a lack of communication between Mr. Smith and Mr. Golden. Another reason why it's unfortunate a hearing was never granted by Circuit Court Judge Caldwell is to determine exactly what was going on, to see if there was in fact a real need to assign substitute counsel. But at the very worst case scenario, Mr. Smith's appeal should have been perfected. There is no legitimate or legal reason that I can think of as to why Golden or somebody else could not have timely perfected the appeal so that Smith could have then been represented by some other attorney if there was an attorney problem, or whether or not Golden could have continued and submitted a brief. Even if an attorney is not getting along with his client, which is probably not a rare occurrence in jurisprudence, there is no reason why he couldn't have timely filed a notice of appeal. None.
To go back for a minute, did the Meyer Henry firm or Mark Meyer Henry handle the direct appeal to the state Supreme Court?
I believe he did, yes.
Okay. And he didn't raise at all any question about the mandatory instruction?
That's correct. And I believe he admitted at the at one of the habeas corpuses hearing subsequently held that he couldn't explain why he didn't, that apparently he must not have noticed the issue, but he couldn't explain why he did not raise that issue below.
So that instruction wasn't even requested at the trial level?
That's correct. I believe the cautionary instruction was requested. I don't recall who requested it. You'll have to excuse me. I'm not extremely familiar with this very long, complex case, but if I recall correctly, it was requested, but the corroboration instruction, the mandatory instruction under 114.8 was not requested by either the court, the state, or Mr. Meyer Henry. And I think it just got through, unfortunately. It just fell through the cracks that instruction, unfortunately, was not given, especially in such an important case. Now, to get back to Mr. Golden, in addition, if the court believed Mr. Golden's position was correct, as he stated in his motion to withdraw, Judge Caldwell should have held a hearing and determined whether or not there was facts to support Mr. Golden's position on being removed as counsel, and then she should have questioned Mr. Smith as to whether or not these facts were true as stated by or alleged as Mr. Golden, whether in fact he wanted substitute counsel, or whether he wished to proceed pro se as alleged by Mr. Golden. And if Mr. Smith had wished to proceed pro se, the court had a duty. Legal and duty is defined by a prior case law established by this court to have an on-the-record exchange with Mr. Smith as to whether he understood the pitfalls of representing himself and whether or not he understood those pitfalls and nevertheless wished to proceed pro se. That exchange was never held, and so it was never determined whether Mr. Smith wished to proceed pro se. What we do know is that the appeal was not timely taken, and so no briefing was allowed, and this court dismissed. I don't think there was anything to dismiss. The appeal was not timely taken, and so Mr. Smith was denied the opportunity to appeal. He then promptly filed a second petition, or a petition to have a second habeas corpus action. So subsequently, Justice Stuart Tiede ultimately determined that res judicata prevented Mr. Smith from raising all the issues that he wished to raise in that first habeas corpus action because they either had been previously determined by this court on direct appeal or because he was afforded an opportunity to appeal those in the first habeas corpus action and didn't, and thereby was prevented from discussing those issues in the second habeas corpus action. I would like to state and reiterate that in order to have proceeded pro se, there had to be a valid waiver of the right to counsel. I believe the law is very clear. And in the case of Ferretta versus California, the United States Supreme Court stated that to grant a request to proceed pro se, there must be a showing that the defendant knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived his right to counsel, and that a defendant should be made aware of the dangers and the disadvantages.
Was that a direct appeal, though? That wasn't a habeas, where the court's making those findings.
In the Ferretta versus California? No, I don't believe that. I believe that's correct, Justice Cunningham, yes. But I don't see why that same factual scenario would not equally apply to a habeas corpus case, even though in a habeas corpus case you're talking about a collateral attack on a conviction. I believe our Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court or other state courts have made it clear that you're talking about the same rights to effective assistance of counsel, that they're not limited in a habeas corpus case. So
you're talking about waiver of counsel. Here, as I understand it, the federal courts have said there is no right to counsel in a habeas case necessarily.
Well, I think it's not of constitutional dimension. I believe it's one of statutory creation. At least in South Dakota, the right to counsel is granted by our legislature as codified in South Dakota codified laws. But since we have done that, then it becomes, well, what does that mean? Is the right to counsel the right to effective assistance of counsel? This court has stated it is. The right to effective assistance of counsel. And if you're talking about the right to effective assistance of counsel, why should effective assistance of counsel be any less than effective assistance of counsel at a trial court level?
Your time has expired, Mr. Ehrenberg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, you have 20 minutes, sir.
I thank the court for its time in addressing Mr. Ehrenberg's arguments. Now, the defense here, the petitioner, is raising three issues: whether the trial court committed reversible error in failure to give the jury instruction requiring corroboration of an accomplice's testimony, two, whether Smith is entitled to habeas corpus relief on the ground he received ineffective assistance of counsel in his first habeas corpus case, and three, whether Smith is entitled to habeas corpus relief upon the ground he received ineffective counsel in his second habeas corpus case. I believe that Mr. Ehrenberg has argued mainly the first two issues, so I'd like to address those. And for the third one, rely on my brief, except to the extent that what happened in the second habeas case, I think, is instructive of what's going on behind the scenes in the first habeas. Now, in the first habeas corpus case, it started out with John Schlimgen being appointed counsel. And for reasons that aren't in the record, there are about 3 years or so with no activity in the file. Mr. Schlimgen was replaced by Mr. Ehrenberg, who was only on the case a couple of days when the state requested that the law firm that Deb Bergen worked for be appointed. Apparently there was the county had entered into a relationship with that law firm that they would function as a public defender's office handling criminal cases. Now, when Ms. Bergen took over, the case seemed, when you look at the record, the case kind of snowballed out of control. It started out with Mr. Smith making maybe three or four claims for relief. That snowballed into a second petition with, I think, 42. It ended up eventually with over 60 claims. And a lot of these were repetitious. A lot of them were matters that were res judicata from the direct appeal. And a lot of them were, frankly, irrelevant. They spent a great deal of time in the evidentiary hearing, actually in both habeas, with Smith challenging the death penalty. And what does that have to do with anything practically when he didn't get the death penalty? There's a great deal of backing and filling. Now, at the habeas corpus hearing in the first proceeding, Mr. Meyer Henry testified, and he testified that to a large extent, he was going against the death penalty too, and that's the way the argument went, and Ms. Bergen let that go ahead. Eventually, Ms. Bergen filed a motion for a certificate of probable cause listing 14 issues. If you look at those 14 issues, I didn't put them in the brief, but I cited that part of the record. Again, it's largely death penalty and direct appeal issues that were already decided. Now, when it came to pass that she was taken off the case by Judge Caldwell, that was because of apparently the apparent conflict of interest when Mr. Mark Arndt, the deputy state's attorney who handled the first habeas hearing, went to that law firm. Now, I don't think on the basis of a little record there is, we can really say that Judge Caldwell abused her discretion. there was a potential conflict there, and, you know, she appointed Mr. Golden. When Mr. Golden tried to contact Mr. Smith in the penitentiary, he ran into a brick wall. Mr. Smith would not meet with him personally at the penitentiary. Mr. Smith would not, it turned out he wasn't even, he was refusing mail. And the same thing happened in the second habeas. And what happened in the second habeas cast light on what was going on in the first habeas at the time of appeal. When you look at what happened to Mr. Peterson ended up being threatened in a habeas hearing in open court that if he showed up at the penitentiary, Smith would be glad to meet with him and he'd break his arm. Now, when you look at these two habeas cases, one after another, you have to come to the conclusion that the fault here, the reason why an appeal was not perfected, is not the fault of Mr. Golden. It's not the fault of Judge Caldwell. It's the defendant's fault. A defendant can't pin habeas corpus relief for ineffective counsel on his own failure to work with his counsel. And you look at the case laws I cited in my brief, you look at Tallarico, where you're not entitled to new counsel simply because you refuse to work with your current counsel.
Did the court make specific findings on this, that he failed to cooperate with these attorneys?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Did the court make findings of fact on this, or is this your spin?
That is what Judge Teede concluded in the second habeas. He specifically laid the fault at the feet of Mr. Smith. And I think that that, on the record, is correct. Now, when you look at what, at, you know, the position in this appeal, I still think that when you come to the second habeas that Judge Teede conducted, you still have to meet the cause and prejudice standard. And there is no cause and there is no prejudice when the problem lies at the defendant and not at the feet of counsel. The big issue, really, I think the only issue that has any real life in this case, as far as challenging the original conviction, is the first issue regarding the jury instruction, which was left out. Now, the trial court was requested to issue the instruction that an accomplice's testimony is to be viewed with caution, and the jury is to give it whatever weight it deems appropriate in light of the rest of the evidence in the case. That was requested, that was given. It was given orally, it was given in writing. No one requested the additional instruction, which is required under statute, that there be corroboration of the accomplice's testimony. Now, Mr. Ehrenberg has argued that this is a structural error. Well, it's not. This court in that arson case, Hayes v. Weber, looked at where there was absolutely no accomplice instruction and said that basically it was harmless error, that because the evidence was so overwhelming and the defendant, in fact, himself corroborated much of the accomplice's testimony, there really, you know, was a harmless error. The same thing is true here. And Judge Teede stressed that very heavily in his finds, facts, conclusions of law, and his memorandum opinion. When you look at the accomplice's testimony, the accomplice described some of the background of their traveling around and basically committing burglaries to support themselves, and some of the other acts which occurred in preparation for the bank robbery. He also testified as to what happened in the bank itself and, you know, described Mr. Smith's shooting. Now, when you look at the testimony of the women who were present in the bank, at least one of them says, she's right there, he pulls out the gun, he turns around, he points it, and he fires. That was the only gunshot fired. There really isn't too much question based on that testimony who did the shooting. As far as any claims that Smith wasn't involved, you have his shoe print on the counter in the bank when all the witnesses say the taller and bigger of the two, and Smith was much taller and bigger than Wood, jumped over the counter, you know, to get the money from the teller. One other thing Judge Tiede noted was that Smith, when he was caught, had a great deal of marked money from the robbery on his person, also in his car. This wasn't a case where any of the evidentiary issues the defendant tries to raise make any difference. And this jury instruction, which was not given, and that's true, that jury instruction would not have made any difference. It was harmless error. Harmless error is appropriate in this circumstance. Now, the way this court looks at erroneous jury instructions is whether, number one, whether the substance is covered in the body of the jury instructions as a whole, and also whether the error would have infected the entire trial with unfairness. And that is clearly not the case here, as Justice Sabers was pointing to in his questioning of Mr. Ehrenberg. So basically, that issue just has no life. And there's no grounds for relief based on that. And I don't think there are any grounds at all in this case for relief. I would ask this court.
How do you define structural error?
Structural error is such a fundamental error that there can't be harmless error. It goes to the very nature of the proceeding that if that kind of thing applies when, for instance, if you have a jury picked on racial grounds. I mean, you have to look at something that renders the whole trial unfair, and that's not the case here regarding that jury instruction. To a certain extent, the substance of the instruction was present in the other jury instructions because they were advised to view it with caution. That gets you into the corroboration is sort of interwoven with that. Now, the corroboration instruction wasn't given, but as I point out and as Judge Tiede ruled, there really was no question here that there was sufficient corroboration. Now, Mr. Ehrenberg argues that, of course, that's the trial court, I mean, the appellate court putting itself in the place of the jury. Well, that doesn't really hold any water because appellate courts assess errors for harmlessness every day. This court does it all the time, and it's done it in reference to this particular kind of error before. So, you know, there really is no structural error in this record. And on that basis, I'd ask the court to affirm Judge Tiede's denial of habeas corpus relief.
Let me ask you just one question about the Peterson ineffective claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
That, the Supreme Court has pretty well settled law that you don't consider an ineffective assistance claim on direct appeal. So wouldn't the Peterson ineffective claim be one on direct appeal now to this court? What record does the court look at to determine?
Well, that's an interesting question. Since this is a habeas corpus, is it exactly in the same posture as a direct appeal? And as a general proposition, I would think it would be. But in this case, you have Peterson essentially had the opportunity to defend himself to a certain extent in the habeas hearings themselves, where Judge Tiede had three hearings.
There wasn't any testimony under oath, though, by Peterson, as I looked through those hearings.
That's quite true. And another thing which I think points in the direction you're going, or that you're asking about, is that the allegations of ineffective counsel against Mr. Peterson are dealing with things that were not in existence at the time that Mr. Peterson was explaining himself to the habeas court. I mean, it comes down to failure to preserve issues, and Mr. Peterson would not have had an opportunity to address that. But that leads to going down the road to another habeas corpus, which, to be fair to Mr. Peterson, might be appropriate. But if you look at the issues that Mr. Peterson is accused of not preserving, there's no validity to them anyway. I didn't follow that part of the appellant's brief very well.
Well, the Supreme Court has said absent special circumstances, that issue wouldn't be taken on direct appeal. Are there special circumstances in this case because of Mr. Smith's failure to cooperate and the record that's been made in front of the habeas court?
That might very well be, because Mr. Smith converted the evidentiary hearings into a farce. I mean, you have him using foul language that Judge Tede offers him the opportunity to testify in support of his petition, and Mr. Smith basically responds, no, I'm a liar. It's my religion to lie. Expletive deleted. And on that basis, I would think that the defendant's arguments against Mr. Peterson just don't hold water. And there is enough of a record, I think, here to find that there is no grounds for relief. And in summary, I simply request the court to affirm Judge Tede's determinations.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Ehrenberg, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. The state has argued that it was no fault of Mr. Golden to fail to protect Mr. Smith's appellate rights, and that Golden ran into a brick wall at the penitentiary. I don't believe that's correct, Your Honors, and it's a crucial point, because even if you assume that Mr. Smith was hard to get along with and did not want to meet with Mr. Golden in a particular place in the penitentiary where privacy would be compromised, that still did not prohibit Golden from at least doing a very, very simple thing, filing a notice of appeal on time. There is nothing that Smith did or could have done that would have prevented Mr. Golden from timely filing that notice of appeal.
Don't you have to get your client's permission?
I don't see why. I mean, he knew that he wanted to appeal. It was his duty to appeal. That's why Mr. Golden was put in, substituted by Judge Caldwell, is because Bergen had already requested the court issue a certificate of probable cause. So Golden knew that Smith wanted to file the appeal. And he had received no contrary evidence from Mr. Smith, and there's no evidence in the record from Mr. Smith or anybody else that Mr. Smith did not want to proceed with this appeal. So I think Golden was obligated to assume Mr. Smith wanted to timely to perfect his appeal and then assert his various issues on appeal. It would have certainly been contrary to Mr. Smith's character to not want to raise all the issues that he could have on appeal. There's no indication of any kind in the record that Mr. Smith wanted to abandon his appellate rights. And so there's nothing also in the record to have prevented Mr. Golden from timely perfecting. And then once his client's rights, no matter how he viewed his client, certainly Mr. Smith will never win a popularity contest, but that's not the issue. The issue is, did Mr. Smith do anything to prevent Golden from filing an appeal? Evidently, not even Golden asserts that Smith told me, I want to abandon my appeal. Don't do anything. That's not in the record.
Doesn't Smith have an obligation, if he refuses to cooperate with his own counsel, his court-appointed counsel, for any particular reason, doesn't he have an obligation to write to the judge and ask for that counsel to withdraw or be replaced and that he get new counsel?
Well, that, number one, assumes that Mr. Smith was unhappy with Mr. Golden. We don't know that because just Judge Caldwell never granted a hearing to determine, are there problems? Are there attorney-client problems? And if there are, what can be done? I think Mr. Smith was somewhat sandbagged, or at least very surprised, to determine that Mr. Golden was going to be allowed to withdraw from the case 5 days after his time from perfecting his appeal had run, and learning that there were attorney-client problems. I think Mr. Smith was the last to know, as he was the last to know in the substitution of counsel of Golden for Bergen to begin with. And so I think the record makes clear that Judge Caldwell prepared and filed a certificate of probable cause on October 2nd of 2001. And then on the next thing that happens in the record is on October 10th, Golden files a motion to withdraw. Without a hearing on November 8th, at least 5 days after the time for effecting the appeal had occurred, Judge Caldwell issued an order permitting Golden to withdraw. Judge Caldwell, unfortunately, didn't hold a trial to determine whether or not the circuit court still retained jurisdiction to determine this matter. Secondly, there was no determination to determine what Smith's true position was. Was there a problem with his attorney? Did he not want his attorney to take certain actions? And if he didn't want his attorney to take certain actions, what did Mr. Smith need to do to perfect his appeal? Or could substitute counsel be, could another attorney been substituted in time to perfect Mr. Smith's appeal? Did Mr. Smith knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waive his right to counsel? And that, again, that's the right to effective assistance of counsel.
But Judge Caldwell's failure to hold a hearing could not have been the cause of the failure to file the notice of appeal, because by the time she allowed the withdrawal, the time for appeal had already expired.
That's right, but that doesn't mean a hearing couldn't have been held prior to that date. We only know from the bare record that we have is that she issued her order permitting Golden to withdraw on November 8th. But the record shows that Golden evidently filed his motion. It may have been signed prior to that, but it was filed with the clerk on October 10th. So there was still, because a certificate of probable cause issued on October 2nd, he evidently had until, and I'm not sure of the exact day, but he had until approximately November 2nd to get his notice of appeal filed. So between the date, so there was certainly time between the filing of the motion to withdraw on October 2nd of 2001 until the time for filing ceased on November 2nd, or approximately November 2nd of 2001, where a hearing could have been granted to resolve these issues. Or the judge could have said, had Mr. Golden come to her office and said, I see you've got to want to file this motion, but I remind you, sir, you know, that the time for perfecting the appeal is November 2nd. You know, perfect the appeal, and then either I or the Supreme Court will resolve the issue as to whether or not counsel should be substituted, or whether or not you will be wished to, or you'll be granted a right to proceed pro se, if that is in fact your wish. There is just no legal cause, no factual cause, why the notice of appeal could not have been timely perfected and Mr. Smith's appellate rights preserved. And that is structural error. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ehrenberg. Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.